Hello, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. This is episode 14 of The Blender. I am Pavel Butorin, a producer at RFURL, and I'll be your host this week. I'd just like to take a moment and thank our listeners for their continued support for this podcast on iTunes and on our website at rferl.org. In this episode, we talk about the struggle of some Russian mothers who are helping their children cope with a disease that most people have never heard of.
It's time to start doing something in this country. We need to find qualified doctors.
I also caught up with the editors of our From Our Bureau's Desk, Pete Baumgartner and Merhad Sharibjan, for another installment of Uncovered, a discussion of important stories from our broadcast region that we think are being underreported in the West.
They want to divorce their wife that they've left back in Tajikistan, and what's been happening is they've been sending SMS text messages back to their wives in Tajikistan that just say talak, talak, talak.
And as a controversial ban of a full-face Islamic veil has come into effect in France this week, I sit down with my colleagues covering Uzbekistan, Chechnya, and Iran to discuss their reactions to the veil ban in France.
I have never heard that women get together and said what men should wear. We don't care.
Yes, that was a lively discussion we had, and you'll hear more of it in a few minutes. But first, to Russia. Imagine having skin so delicate that even simple acts, like rubbing your eyes or scratching an itch, can leave you covered in painful blisters. That's the fate of people who suffer from the rare disease epidermolysis bullosa, or EB. EB is so uncommon that in many parts of the world, children with the disease go undiagnosed. Daisy Sindelar reports on efforts in Russia to ensure children with EB get the care and attention they deserve.
Russian mother Yulia Kopseva gently rubs cream onto the chubby legs of her daughter Nastya. Nastya is a rosy-cheeked toddler with curly blonde hair and a cheerful smile, but her hands are covered with soft cloth bandages. Underneath, her fingers are covered with painful red blisters. Nastya suffers from epidermolysis bullosa, or EB, a rare genetic disease which makes patients' skin extremely delicate and vulnerable to injury. Even the slightest abrasion can lead to painful blisters and lesions. Young sufferers of EB are sometimes called butterfly children because their skin is as easily damaged as an insect's wings. There are treatments that ease the symptoms of EB, but Yulia worries that Russia's poor health care and lack of public education are keeping her child from getting the assistance she needs.
It's time to start doing something in this country. We need to find qualified doctors. We need to teach mothers how to care for their children at home. We need to do it for these children who have the right to live and to have a normal and happy childhood.
In an effort to raise awareness, Yulia and a friend, Elena Kuratova, have founded a charity called Bella to help support families affected by EB. Just one person in 50,000 suffers from EB. In Russia, Elena says, so few people know about the rare disease that many children are misdiagnosed or even kept in unofficial quarantine, isolated from their peers, even though the illness is not contagious.
There are very few children with this disease in Moscow, and their mothers have to lead miserable lives at home, alone with their troubles. In other countries, children with this disease are just regular people with certain limitations. Here, they are truly disabled.
Yulia and Elena have looked to support groups and charities abroad to learn how EB is treated in the West. In the course of their work, they've met advocates in the Czech Republic and Germany who have given them ideas about how to better support families back in Russia. Sandy Katzer of the DermaKids Foundation in Germany says her country offers special support to parents who tend to children with EB at home.
When the family leaves the hospital here in Germany, we send a trained nurse who shows the parents how to take care of the child at home.
The Bella organization is now trying to offer the same types of assistance back in Russia. Material support for families who often cannot afford even the special bandages needed to cover their children's tender skin. Back in Moscow, Kobsova gently guides Nastya as she takes wobbly toddler steps around the family living room, her bandaged hands wrapped tenderly around her mother's fingers for support. In turn, Kobsova says the only support she and other parents of children with EB need is a little extra information and money.
The main thing is that it's all possible. If it were impossible to provide any relief, then we wouldn't bother going through all of this. My daughter is not disabled. She is just like the princess and the pea. She cannot sleep on a rough surface or let her skin get scratched because she is a princess.
Kobsova says it is the state's obligation to fund treatment for all diseases, no matter how rare. With the right support, she says, Russia can ensure a high quality of life for these butterfly children and their families.
That was Daisy Sindelar on the efforts of one determined mother to raise awareness in Russia about the plight of children with epidermolysis bullosa, or EB. The story was based on reporting by Anton Shiraev and Galina Shiraeva of our Russian service. To see a video about Russia's butterfly children, visit our website at rferl.org. And now it's time for our regular segment we call Uncovered. This is where we dig a little deeper and look at some of the best original reporting coming out of RFERL's 20 local bureaus. I am joined in the studio by editors Pete Baumgartner and Merhat Sharibjan.
Let's start with a story out of Pakistan, where the National Assembly, Pakistani Parliament, is considering a bill that would toughen the punishment for people who commit acid attacks on women. Pete, what is this story about?
Well, it's a very interesting story. This has been a problem in Pakistan and in Bangladesh and Afghanistan and other countries for a long time, and it's these acid attacks by men, most of them who have been either rejected or have some problem with a girlfriend or a wife. And what they do is they'll throw acid in their faces, but usually when they're sleeping or when they least expect it. And then they end up being seriously disfigured and sometimes blinded. It's really a horrible crime. And this is...
How common are these attacks?
Well, in Pakistan last year, they said that there were only about 150 officially registered incidents. But unofficially, they think there are a lot more than that.
What's the current punishment?
Currently, it's only between 5 and 14 years in jail, which is relatively light when you consider how horrible it is. And that's why this new law that's being considered by the parliament would actually make it life imprisonment and also a fine of 1 million rupees, which is about almost $12,000, which is a pretty significant fine in Pakistan.
Where, if I may ask, where does one get acid? Is it that easy to obtain?
You know, I don't really know. I don't think it is. But the people who will sell it will also be liable to be prosecuted under this law.
Okay, here's another story that caught my attention. It's about Nursultan Nazarbayev, who was inaugurated for yet another term as president of Kazakhstan last week. And while the presidential election has been reported on, I think this little aspect escaped the attention of the Western press. Merhat, what exactly happened during the inauguration ceremony?
Well, during the inauguration ceremony, Nazarbayev made at least 8 different mistakes, grammatical, stylistic. He omitted such words as constitution and president. He used some words which sounded similar but had a very different meaning. Instead of saying, I will strictly follow the constitution and laws in Kazakhstan, he said, I severely follow, and things like that.
And why is that significant?
It is significant because Kazakh laws require that any presidential candidate should go through special Kazakh test or test on the knowledge of the Kazakh language. This year it was even more severe. Only 1 or 2 mistakes were allowed. And
were some candidates disbanded from...
Yeah, there were several candidates who were nixed and were not able to take part in the polls because they were considered not to know the Kazakh language enough to be president. Meanwhile, at least 2 of the candidates were allowed to take part in the elections, other than Nazarbayev. One of them speaks very stumbly Kazakh. Another one doesn't speak Kazakh, we can say, at all. He knows probably several words, but they passed the examination. In other words, this examination was used by Nazarbayev and his party, Nur-Otan, to bar candidates from the elections.
And so as a result of this election, Nazarbayev is going to be president for how much longer?
He's going to be president for 5 more years. They replaced the term, which was 7 before. Kazakhstan agreed with OSCE's requirements before becoming the chairman of before obtaining a chairmanship of the OSCE a couple of years ago. So now it's 5 years.
Now, this is a curious story that you guys have reported this week. Tajikistan's religious authorities are set to issue a fatwa banning so-called SMS divorces. SMS divorces, what's all that about?
Well, with the advent of mobile phones and the fact that almost everyone has one now, even in poor countries like Tajikistan, men have been using new technology to divorce their wives. In Islam, you can divorce your wife by repeating the word talak 3 times. There are hundreds of thousands, actually, of Tajiks working in Russia, and many of them, after they go there to work, find new girlfriends or even new wives, and they want to divorce their wife that they've left back in Tajikistan. And what's been happening is they've been sending SMS text messages back to their wives in Tajikistan that just say talak, talak, talak.
And the Tajik religious authorities don't like that?
Yeah, it's a bit contradicting to the Islamic traditions, because as far as I know, talak words are supposed to be repeated 3 times in presence of witnesses. Because especially nowadays, even wives can find new boyfriends and say that, claim that their husband said talak 3 times to them, but the husband can say, no, I never said that. So witnesses are supposed to be there. And the thing is that it's sent by SMS. Also, is very contradictory, because nobody knows who used that mobile phone, which belonged to the lady's husband. According to the laws and regulations in Islam, the whole idea is very controversial to start with.
One last thing. In Sunni Islam, a fatwa is actually just a religious opinion, and it's non-binding. So this is more of a recommendation or advice than it is actual law. They don't actually, and Tajikistan is a nominally Sunni Muslim country.
But in Tajikistan, don't marriages have to be registered officially with some government authority?
Well, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, especially in remote villages, the registration is not necessarily a must. People just got married, just go to a local mosque or invite a mullah to their house, and this is it. They are husbands and wives, and there are no official registrations. Even sometimes when there are registrations, in countries like Tajikistan or any other country in the former Soviet Union, I mean in Central Asia or Caucasus, things can be solved easily.
Okay, Pete Baumgartner and Mirhad Sharipjan, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Говорить радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда гуш میکنی.
Машал радіо Дамілі
Азатун ДТМ.
Радіо Азатун. 28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
And finally, we turn to a subject that has been widely debated in Belgium, France, and many other European nations. The debate centers on a controversial law that effectively bans Muslim women from wearing a full-face veil in public. It's the first such nationwide ban to be enforced in a European Union country. Proponents of the ban, which enjoys broad public support in France, argue that it is necessary on grounds of security, gender equality, and upholding France's secular system. But critics say it violates rights such as freedom of expression and religion. The news from France sparked a lively debate in our broadcast region, a large part of which is Muslim. Earlier this week, I had a chat on this subject with Zamira Ishanova of RFERL's Uzbek service, Amina Umarova of the North Caucasus service, and Golnaz Isfandiari, our correspondent in Washington who covers Iran. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you.
So we have been covering this story for some time, and our latest story actually on our website, on our English language website, has probably one of the lengthiest discussion threads that I've seen. These comments reflect a rather broad range of views on this matter. And actually, to get this discussion started, let me read out some of the comments for you. Here's a female reader from Britain. Nowhere in the Quran does it say women must be covered head to toe. This is a form of control that men get to use on their wives and daughters. This law says no more. Good job, France. Another comment goes like this. How can you tell who's under the burqa and what they are carrying? In major cities, this is a public safety concern. Another comment from a reader from Turkey. Perhaps you could consider the possibility that this law is a simple expression of anti-Muslim prejudice. May we call a spade a spade? Okay, let me turn first to Gulnaz in Washington. Gulnaz, you grew up in Iran, a country where the state actually wants women to adhere to a certain dress code. Have you seen any reactions in the Iranian media, in the Iranian state media, to this most recent veil ban in France?
Well, in general, the Iranian government and Iranian state media, they've been following this issue since the talk started in France and also in other countries. And in general, they see it as a violation of women's rights. But as you said, this comes from a government where it actually forces women in Iran to wear the veil. We grew up, we were forced to do so, and it violates the rights of the woman in its own country, and then it speaks up about what's happening in France. But there's always a disconnect between the state officials' sort of stance and also what people in the streets think or what you read in the blogs of Iranians.
Would you care to share with us your personal position, if you have one, on this issue?
Well, I think it's as wrong it is to force someone to wear a veil. It's also wrong to force someone not to wear one. I think women, I mean, anybody need to have a choice. This is what is not given to women in Iran. And now in France, it's not necessarily, I'm not pro women wearing the niqab. I haven't seen anything about it in Islam, and I don't think it's the right thing to do. But I think people should be able to choose what they want to wear. I mean, to a certain extent, they should be respectful to the country they're living in and to the culture and to other people, of course.
Thank you, Gulnaz. Let me turn now to Zamira Eshanova of our Uzbek service. I understand that there is something of a media campaign in Uzbekistan to actually talk women out of that, out of wearing full-on Islamic dress. Is that correct?
Yes, Pavel. Actually, when Nicolas Sarkozy suggested this law to the parliament, we were laughing because it was kind of deja vu for us, because Sarkozy, instead of somehow exporting democratic values and things like that to undemocratic countries, somehow he seemed to follow this undemocratic, quite restrictive policies of authoritarian regimes. We were laughing, you know, Sarkozy is learning now in Tashkent or from Tashkent. So in Uzbekistan, according to the 1998 law, undefined religious clothing, because law doesn't define what does it mean, is forbidden. You know, you are there is a ban to wear religious clothing in public. So it means you cannot go in Uzbekistan to the street or to the public places in dresses like what is now banned in France, which is full niqab, which covers you fully, your face and your body.
Is that something that is culturally unacceptable, or is it also imposed by the government?
No, because just Gulnaz mentioned that Islam doesn't require women to wear, you know, to cover her face fully. So that's why Uzbek government is insisting that it's against our cultural, you know, heritage. It's against Islamic rules. That's why they're propagandating, you know, this kind of traditional Islam, Sunni moderate Islam, where you have to cover your head, your hair only, and your neck. Maybe that's it. So that's why the government's propaganda machine is now working against this kind of Wahhabist. It's called Wahhabist elements, because this is this burqa, this niqab, I think, comes mostly from Wahhabist sect of Islam.
Okay, Amina, how is it in the North Caucasus and in Chechnya and other Muslim North Caucasus areas? I understand there is a little bit of an opposite process, where Ramzan Kadyrov, the current head of the Chechen Republic, he's actually trying to impose a certain Islamic dress code. Is that right?
Yeah, Kadyrov is somehow trying to force Chechen women to wear this, like you said, Islamic dress. But actually, every Chechen woman, I think, they can say it's not Kadyrov's business what to wear, how to wear. And I don't think it's Sarkozy's business, too, because both of them, they don't care about women's rights. They're both pursuing their political purposes. And there is nothing about women. They don't even care. And it's quite ridiculous. When Soviet regime, I remember, there were statements, just take off your headscarf. So when the new government came, it said, just put on your headscarf. In Chechnya, Kadyrov shouldn't be so concerned about women's dress. There are 5,000 dead bodies in dozens of mass graves. Chechnya desperately needs a forensic lab, and there are tens, if not tens thousands of young Chechen men who were just arrested during the wars, and they are just in Russian prisons in everywhere in Siberia and Ural and Far East. Why is this all about women's dress?
It's exactly this. The answer to your question is exactly to divert society's attention from this kind of very big and fundamental problems. I think they always focus on this kind of things. This is, of course, political truth.
I have never heard that women get together and said what men should wear. We don't care. Just be modest, just wear, you know, proper dress, and that's it. And who cares? Yeah. It's only
in Iran, there are actually some guidelines also for men. So,
but not as strict
as for women. But if I may, Pavel, I think one thing is that missing from the debate is that forcing those women not to wear the niqab is not going to change the way they think or the way their husbands think about the whole issue, as it didn't wearing the forcing us to wear the veil in Iran didn't make us more religious or didn't make us believe that this is the right thing to do. Actually, it made us, people like me, hate it when I was growing up in Iran.
How about this argument? Some say that overt displays of Muslim faith or any faith in France in the public sphere are undermining France's secular system. Gulnas, maybe you have a comment about that. I understand that you went to a French school and you probably are very familiar with the French culture. What does that have to do with French secularism?
Well, I think if you speak to some French people, they mind that. And to a certain extent, maybe they're right, you know. I would feel offended if I'm walking in the streets here in Washington and I see a naked man or a naked woman.
Yes.
You know, and I guess for them, seeing a woman in niqab is the same thing. I've talked to French people and this is how some of them feel about it. I was recently in Qatar and I was by the swimming pool in a hotel and I saw this man who was, it was hot and he was enjoying himself in the swimming pool with his children, two little boys, and he was swimming, having fun. And his wife was like wearing a niqab and, you know, she was covered in black. We could only see her face, her eyes, or actually she was also wearing a pair of sunglasses. So we couldn't see much and it was probably very, it wasn't very comfortable for her, but she was standing, you know, there and suffering probably, and it wasn't I felt kind of, you know, very angry about what I saw. So to some extent I understand that some people in France don't want to see women in niqab going outside, but as I said, I think in general it's important to give the people the freedom to choose.
Thank you, Gulnas.
But
yes,
Pavel, yes, I agree to a certain extent with what Gulnas says, but at the same time we live in a society. We live in a multicultural society, and France is not exception. And there should be some rules for the whole society. As you said, if I see in the street a naked woman or naked man, it is unacceptable and it's frightening. And I think people should not make others, you know, to experience this kind of fears just because of their religious beliefs. I believe God or your religion, your beliefs live in your heart, in your soul, and there is not much need to express it in this kind of overwhelmed way, which threatens in a way or frightens the society.
Islam says when you go somewhere, you have to act like people, like it means so society. It doesn't mean that you have to give up your culture, your traditions, but you don't have to, you know, so show them out to the people or to make other people uncomfortable, I think.
So what kind of challenges do you think we have as journalists while covering this highly divisive debate that goes beyond French borders? I mean, Omarova, North Caucasus Service.
We have to be really careful when politicians such as Sarkozy make such a statement. We can see now in our newspapers, in our radio, in our TV, it's like Muslim women wear the veils, they're fighting for it. But it's not what Islam requires. But there is a mistake, but it's a huge mistake. And we should be more careful and more educated than politicians, I think.
But I mean, at the same time, there is a real problem in this Western societies now, and there is a problem with integration, especially this multi-religious, you know,
multicultural,
multi-religious communities, societies.
But it shouldn't be about dress. It shouldn't be about. It should be about education,
exactly.
Giving them better conditions.
There should be more serious discussion in French society, for example, how to integrate this Muslim, you know, diaspora or how we call them. But there is a real, real problem which is French society is facing. But it is not about this niqab or hijab, but it's much deeper, economic, social, you know, how to integrate this population of France into mainstreams. But instead, yes, politicians are picking at this very populist, you know.
And it's a dangerous one.
Yeah, symbols.
This seems to be a very nice conclusion to our discussion. This continues to be a very hotly debated issue, and I'm sure we'll be coming back to it in our future podcasts. I want to thank my panel, Zamira Ishanova of the Uzbek Service, Amina Umarova of the North Caucasus Service, and Golnaz Isfandiari in Washington, D.C.
And thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was our discussion on the full veil ban in France. I'd like to encourage our listeners to leave their comments about this discussion or any other segment of this podcast on our website at rferl.org. And that's all the time we have for this week. Don't forget to check out rferl.org for more about these or any other stories from our vast broadcast region. I want to thank our producer Tanya Kancheva and all those who are involved in making this podcast. If you've got a comment about the blender, send it to podcast@rferl.org or leave a message on the blender page at rferl.org. Until next week, this is Pavel Butorin. Take care.